For the week of October 26th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 255, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Hong Kong, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wow, okay, I did not realize you were in Hong Kong. You must be protesting for democracy.
Oh, I would be. My dad did it when he lived in Hong Kong. He went there for a June 4th ceremony when people protested to commemorate Tiananmen Square when he lived there. But he left right when China did the takeover. But I'm here, of course, for Hollywood. You know, there's a lot going on.
Ah, okay. So you must be talking about what we do every week. We crunch all the news down, all the entertainment news, into digestible, somewhat digestible bits for our listeners. And of course, this week we have some news about China. So that must be what you're referring to.
Exactly. Tell us what we're going to talk about.
Well, on this week's show, we'll be talking about Hollywood's continuing love affair with China. Although this time, it's not Hollywood that's courting China, but rather China showing up at Hollywood's doorstep. Literally. Jack Ma, the founder of China's e-commerce giant Alibaba, is reportedly in negotiations to purchase 37% of Lionsgate. We'll also go over some highlights from the technical conference held last week by the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. That's SMPTE, kind of a mouthful there. They're the ones that do all the standards around, equipment used in movies and television. Turns out there's a whole lot of newfangled technology that is going to make our movies and television shows brighter, more crisp, more immersive, sound better. The one catches how and if all these new enhancements can make it onto the big screen, and why no current small screen, and by small screen I mean, a television set, how none of them are capable of handling all these new features, especially 4K. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're talking about box office around the world. We got our figures from RentTrak. We have a link in our show notes. We also pull info from Variety and Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, you name it. We have North American charts from Box Office Mojo, and we have a link to them. They're back in business, thank goodness. We don't know what happened that one weekend they disappeared, but they're there. They're doing it. And everybody's talking about the number one film around the world, which is a scary little doll. It's Annabelle.
Yes.
$29 million. It passed the $200 million mark worldwide. Hugely profitable film for Warner Brothers.
Now, did you ever expect to hear that Annabelle would be the number one film, okay, maybe in North America, but around the world?
Sure, why not? People like horror films.
Okay.
I mean, look at number four. That's Ouija. This movie opened up mostly in North America. It grossed $21 million, just a little bit overseas. But it's the third film based on that, it's not a board game, a novelty toy? I don't know what to call it, the Ouija board. It's the third film. There was one in Latin America. There's a couple of them, made overseas in different languages. And now finally Hollywood has stepped up to the plate and made Ouija the film. That grossed $21 million too.
What I loved was listening to all the reviews and all the news stories about movies opening this weekend and all of the newscasters or reviewers trying to pronounce Ouija.
They didn't know how to pronounce Ouija? They were never there trying to speak to the dead?
No, Waja was one pronunciation. Uja was another.
Well, it's the weekend before Halloween.
Okay.
And I was confused on Saturday because suddenly I saw kids everywhere in little costumes, and I didn't get the memo about Saturday before Halloween is when you celebrate, apparently, when you've got little children. But apparently that's how it works because it's on a Friday. So I, as an adult, I guess I thought adults would just go out on Halloween on that Friday. But for kids and families, it happens the weekend before, whatever it is.
Okay. First of all, I want to know, A, who made up this rule? Okay. And B,
I don't know. Everybody, all these kids were suddenly walking around town in costumes. I kept looking at my watch.
Well, I did not get the memo on that one.
What did your kids do? When are they celebrating?
On, Friday, October 31st, a.k.a. Halloween.
Well, I'm with you, but what if... But nonetheless, there were kids all over the city in costume. That's all people on the streets in costume. Apparently, we're behind the times. But anyway, Halloween occurs on a Friday this year. Terrible day for Hollywood because it's the worst night. People don't go to the movies on Halloween, and therefore it just throws off the game for everybody. They'd rather it be on a Wednesday or a Thursday or a Tuesday. That means, of course, you've got Annabelle still at the box office. You got Ouija opening up. Dracula Untold is still in theaters. That made $19 million worldwide. It's at $166 million and counting. But those are all, of course, Halloween-themed films, and that's why they're out right now, and that's why they're making money.
And even though Fury came in number 3 at the worldwide box office, not a Halloween movie. Sounds like a Halloween movie, but
well,
not
one. You skipped over the number 2 film. Why did you go to Fury?
Because it's Gone Girl.
Oh, God. The number 2 movie around the world is Gone Girl, the Ben Affleck film, $29 million. That's at $240 million worldwide. Followed closely by Fury, the Brad Pitt World War II film, Sam Fuller-esque, so I've been told. I look forward to seeing it. It made $24 million. It's at $57 million worldwide. It didn't cost a lot. I think it cost like $60 million, something like that. Where is it?
$68 million it cost.
$68 million. There, that's what I got. I don't know what I did with my figures there. Yeah, so that's a little expensive, and it's got a ways to go to get into profitability, but Brad Pitt will hopefully do it there. At number 5 around the world is Lucy, the Luc Besson film, another $19 million. That's at $434 million. And then a couple of animated films. The Book of Life made $17 million. That's at $47 million worldwide. And Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I guess that's not really animated. It's live action, isn't it?
Well, I guess it depends on whether you consider
how you define it.
Define that, CGI. Yeah.
That's just about to pass $400 million. And down at the bottom of the list is Box Trolls, which is just at $90 million worldwide. Not doing great, but not a hugely expensive film. The Maze Runner, that's at $275 million worldwide. Keanu Reeves made his big comeback. He's in North America. This is where box office prognosticators and all these people drive me nuts. This movie came out, it made $14 million.
Now we should say what movie it is. It's John Wick is the name of the
movie.
John
Wick. It's a film about Keanu Reeves, who's a man, a former, you know, assassin or killer, and he's left the business and he's pulled back in again. And how do they pull him back in? By killing his dog. You know, that really pissed him off, and he's going to fight the bad guys because they killed his dog. I don't blame him. That's terrible. It's a Lionsgate film. It's a Keanu Reeves movie. It wasn't even number 1 for the week. It was number 2. It was beat by Ouija. And yet, because they said, oh, this movie's a dog, it's going to make $2 million. And then, instead of saying, if they predicted it would make $50 million, they'd say it's a disaster. If they predicted it would make $5 million, they say it's a huge success. How about just waiting, see how it opens and go, okay, this is where it opened. Not great, but a decent opening for, you know, Keanu, who hasn't had a big hit in a while. Ouija, it didn't do as well as that, but you know, it's got very good reviews. We'll see where it ends up long term.
And this is John Wick.
Yeah, John Wick, the Keanu Reeves film. What do you mean? That's what
I'm trying to remember if this was the movie that was shot so long ago and then kept on the shelf forever, or whether that movie was it was a Keanu Reeves movie. I think it was already released.
It wasn't this one.
Okay, well, yeah, that's probably true.
He talked about how Hollywood doesn't give him offers anymore. He doesn't get work with big studios, and it's not fun. And here he is making a big studio-type film, but it's not that expensive. And it comes out from Lionsgate, made $14 million in North America. We'll see what his pull is like worldwide. It got pretty good reviews. You know, people are like, hey, it's fun. That's about the gist of it.
And I think the movie I was referring to was 47 Ronin.
That was his last big film. That was not a success story. That's true.
Yeah.
And at number 10 around the world is The Judge, Robert Downey Jr., Robert Duvall, one-time Oscar hopeful. I think it'll probably be forgotten long before Oscar comes around. But it made $11 million, and it just passed the $50 million mark worldwide. You look down at the list, Hercules, Guardians of the Galaxy, Alexander, they all made about $10 million. Hercules is at $240 million. That movie, I was wondering if it would be able to claw its way to $270 million in profitability. It's getting close. Guardians of the Galaxy, of course, is at $750 million worldwide, a massive success. And Steve Carell is in Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. I don't believe this. They say this movie cost, like, what, $20 million to make?
That's just what they paid Steve Carell.
$28 million is what they say it costs. That's one of those budgets with an asterisk, right?
I would have to guess, yes. Unless they both just wanted to make this movie, and by both, I mean Steve Carell and, oh gosh, I'm forgetting her name.
Jennifer Garner?
Thank you. Yes. Unless they just wanted to take a pay cut. Although I guess Jennifer Garner doesn't really make as much money as she used to.
I don't think she was ever a big paycheck in Hollywood, was she?
No, never $20 million. No, but she would earn a decent salary.
I don't know. I mean, what film has she ever opened?
That's a good question. None.
Yeah, no, I don't think she's a big cost, but Steve Carell certainly is. Whether he's deserves that outside of an animated film, I don't know. But, he's been in some noteworthy films. He's got a big Oscar hopeful in Foxcatcher. This is a family film, but I just don't believe it cost $28 million. I mean, that just means they didn't pay him up front and he gets a big chunk of something else at the back end, right?
Right. Well, and there's not going to be much back end on this one, it looks like.
Well, it's at $56 million and counting. It's not tearing it up in North America. I don't think people overseas know the book as well, though I'm sure it's probably sold copies all over the world. You know, it's sort of thing, well, if they claim it costs $28 million, maybe you can call it a hit, but I don't know.
Big Hero 6, I think, will be a hit. I predict that's going to be a hit.
That's a Disney film. It's based on a Marvel property, but it's not a Marvel Universe film. It's not involving superheroes as such. It is an animated movie. It's based on an ongoing comic series, but they've really reworked it dramatically from what I understand. I'm not familiar with the comic book series, but they really took some very minimal elements and created something new here. So I don't think if you're a huge fan of the comic book or the manga, whatever it is, that may not make you happy, but it's opened up overseas in two territories. It made $5 million, got off to a good start. The reviews have been very strong in North America from the trades. So people are very excited. And it looks like a lovable creature that you can hug. Big Hero 6 is this big, plushy, marshmallowy looking robot. And he just wants to hug you all the time. And people love it. So it's got a boy hero, but it appeals to girls. It's got a big action finale. It's gotten good reviews. I'm interested to see it.
Sold. Give me two tickets.
Sold. And my mother went to see St. Vincent, the Bill Murray film, which she said, it's not really a comedy. I guess it's funny, but I guess it's a little more serious than she thought. But that's opening wide. Again, another movie where people are saying, he deserves an Oscar nomination. I don't think he's going to get it here. It made $8 million, and it's now at $9 million and counting in North America. There you go. That's the box office. Did you see anything this weekend?
No, because I was busy looking for the memo where I was supposed to be out trick-or-treating.
Were you away or were you home?
I was home. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Just recovering from the SMPTE conference.
Oh, maybe. I missed one down way at the bottom, which I wanted to mention, which is Breakup Buddies. You know, this was a week where Hollywood movies really dominated. Almost every movie on this list is a Hollywood-generated film. You have to go all the way down to number 20 to find a non-big Hollywood movie, and that is a big Chinese film. It's Breakup Buddies, that buddy comedy we've been talking about. That's at $175 million, basically from China and Hong Kong alone. It's in three territories. That is a lot of money, and we're seeing that more and more. We're not even blinking an eye anymore. That, you know, when a movie makes money in one country or one territory, like China or France, you know, China slash Hong Kong or France, and it makes $100 million, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, and I think I would not be surprised, actually, if Breakup Buddies was one of the top movies in China this year. Although I can tell you three of the top five movies in China this year are actually Hollywood movies.
Well, yeah. I mean, they've got a certain select number that they allow to play in China, and they sometimes pull them before they're even done. But no, of course, Hollywood movies make tons of money in China. I'm just saying, look at the money that they're making. That is a very mature box office that's going to pass Hollywood soon, and you just keep looking at that and see what it does. Here in North America, locally, we'll get back to China in a second, Birdman opened a little wider. That's the Michael Keaton film. That's doing well. That is an Oscar hopeful that still has some momentum. Citizen 4, a documentary film that opened very strongly. It's about Edward Snowden. It opened on five screens and grossed $125,000. That's $25,000 per screen. That's really good for a documentary. And it changed the mind of Harvey Weinstein.
I cannot believe you actually brought that up. I was wondering, as you were talking, I was thinking in the back of my mind, I wonder if I should mention this bit about Harvey Weinstein, who said, I changed my mind about Edward Snowden. I think of him differently now. And I was thinking, you know, who cares that Harvey Weinstein's mind was changed because about Edward Snowden? And then you bring it up.
Well, because he's either a moron or he's completely cynical. I mean, he's a big Obama supporter. I like the president, too. And he's like, Edward Snowden's a traitor. You know, he's doing the party line. He's a traitor. And now he's seen the film, which has absolutely no new information about what Edward Snowden did and the repercussions, which is that he revealed that government officials were lying to Congress, spying on Americans, breaking the law. All of that's been known for a year and a half once Edward Snowden's information came out. So there's nothing new for you to know other than the fact that he revealed wrongdoing by government officials and lies to Congress. But suddenly now that he has a movie to promote, he says, well, you know, he made me see him in a new way. You should go see it. I mean, the guy is just such a cynical carnival barker. It astonishes me. But it's a good movie and you should check it out.
Well, and you say you're an Obama supporter. You are also a registered Republican.
I am a registered Republican, but I have a brain.
Oh, okay. Well, they might kick you out for that because, you know.
That's why I'm not, you know, I'd be a registered independent if I could, but New York State does not have open primaries.
No, but they do have the Ebola virus.
Yes, we do, and I'm pissed at the governor, Andrew Cuomo. He's a complete schmuck. But anyway.
Wow. Okay.
No, well, no, he's a complete schmuck. He's pandering to people's fears. He's not taking actions based on medical fact or science. He's just trying to make Mayor de Blasio look bad. And he's trying to score political points and position himself for president. And he's doing it by taking stupid actions that have nothing to do with medicine or science.
And we should explain to listeners who may not know, a case of Ebola was discovered in New York City.
Well, it's national news. I mean, there's a guy in Texas, him here. You know, it's not exactly
But internationally. Internationally.
Well, we know the guy in Spain. We know people in Spain. No, it's pretty worldwide. You know, I'm pretty sure they're on top of Ebola.
Okay.
But let's talk about IMAX, because IMAX is spreading around the world. They've just got an order for 40 more new screens.
Are you trying to say that IMAX is a virus?
Like I might be. So they've got an order for 40 more new screens. This astonishes me, right? They have 880 screens worldwide.
That's a lot of screens.
That does include 129 screens that are in museums and the like that are not strictly commercial. So they have about 750 worldwide commercial movie IMAX screens that are branded IMAX. I don't know how many of those are actual IMAX and just branded with the IMAX name. But I want to know, they have a backlog of 439 screens to be built. What the hell is taking them so long? That astonishes me. That's all money just sitting there waiting to be made. They're going to grow over 50%. And their IMAX screens, and they're that far behind in building them? That just seems bizarre to me.
Well, okay, that's...
Did all these orders come in last week?
Well, this is what happens when you have companies like IMAX who need to kind of promote the fact that they're doing well or are going to be doing even better. Please buy our stock. And they are out there getting commitments. So they go to Cinepolis in Mexico or Cinemex in Mexico, or they go to Wanda in China, or they go to Cineworld in Europe, and they get... commitments from these exhibitors to build a certain number of screens in specific areas. So they
these
exhibitors are blocking out the area, saying you can't build another IMAX screen within 20 miles or 40 kilometers of this particular venue. It takes the exhibitor then, who is now responsible for building this venue and paying for it, it takes them a while to actually ramp up, build a venue, get the financing in place to have a new build or a retrofit. It's not always IMAX that's paying for this. In fact, most of the time, it's not IMAX that's paying for it. And they're
making money when these get built. They don't pay. They make money, right? Because it's got to be to their specs, and they oversee it, and they get money, and then you open it up, and they make money once it's open. Great. I understand wanting to say, hey, we got more business coming down the road. But at some point, that looks like an incompetently run company. When you've got 439 screens waiting to be built, that's not a sign of a company that's growing. That's a sign of a company that can't get done what they need to get done. So, I mean, they really make money once the screen's open, right?
Yes. That's really when they're making most, because they're, you know, profit participation. They're doing a rev share. Ultimately, they are at the mercy most of the time on the exhibitors themselves and how fast the exhibitor can move. And of course, yes, they want those exhibitors to move
fast. But then they're partnering
fast
with the wrong people. Does IMAX have a reputation of like suddenly they're growing too fast, or they're not being able to grow fast enough? Are they dropping the ball on orders? Are they making too many commitments to people who can't follow through with the funding to actually build these? What's going on?
It's funny you should mention all of those things.
Because you don't want to tell us about it?
Because, yeah, I mean, there's been some talk about, gee, are they growing too fast? There's been some talk about, you have all of these screen commitments out there, and you got to start, when does your new build and when does your installations actually start catching up with the rate at which you're signing on to these, on these new exhibitors and kind of signing on new screens?
Mm-hmm.
You sign on 30 new screens, but you built two.
Yeah, that's starting to look bad.
Right. I mean, it's great that you're getting all these commitments and you're kind of mapping out the world for IMAX screens, but you actually then have to produce them. And I think that's their next push will be to do just that. Right now, they're trying to get as many commitments as possible so that they can go back to the Hollywood studios and say, you see, you want to be a part of this. So let's map out which films will be released in IMAX for the next umpteen years.
Well, it's starting to look bad in my mind. I was astonished to hear that many screens waiting to be built. Whatever's going on, I don't think that reflects well on the company, but maybe I should look into it more. But speaking of IMAX, of course, they're going to be showing, they want to show, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And we quoted Harvey Weinstein earlier talking about Citizen Four. This was at a Producer NY, is that what it's called?
No, it's called, it's a conference called Produced By.
Produced By: NY.
Oh, so it was the produced
New York edition of it. Yeah, yes. Okay. And so Harvey Weinstein spoke and he talked about Netflix and he says, they got vision. He loves these guys. They got vision. And two things confused me. One, the article in, I want to say Variety. Yes. Variety said that the Netflix deal with the Weinstein company for Crouching Tiger, in which they paid money, they could show that movie direct on Netflix day and date if and when it opened up on IMAX in North America. That deal cast a shadow over this producer's event. I'm like, I can understand it casting a shadow over exhibitors. I can understand it casting a shadow over, I don't know, TV. I can't understand why producers would be upset by a new company with money to spend.
Yeah, I'm like, what kind of shadow was it? Was it more like
the shadow of joy?
Yeah, I mean, were you inside? Because maybe you just didn't get a good weather report.
Because what do producers love more than people with money who say, I want to make movies, right? That's the Hollywood, yay! They say, come on in, Saudi Arabia. Come on in, Japanese businessmen. Come on in, high-tech guys. Guess what? You know, Michael Keaton has this film about beekeepers set in Antarctica. It's 5 hours long. It's in Latin. You're going to love it. It's a passion project of his. They love to get all their crappy, you know, pet projects out of the way and soak you for all your money and then send you on your way.
Right. And well, they send you on your way until the court case, that is.
Until the court case, yeah. The other thing that surprised me that the Weinstein said was he was surprised by the backlash and the boycott of the chains over Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon Part 2. He said he was surprised by the outcry because, quote, honestly, we thought IMAX had that in hand, end quote. Now, who's the idiot here? Did IMAX promise something they couldn't deliver? Is Harvey Weinstein just plain dumb? Is he actually surprised? I mean, no, IMAX had never, ever done anything like this. You had to know that the theater chains were going to react vociferously to the idea that they would show a movie in their theaters day and date when it came out on streaming video on demand on Netflix. They freaked out a year earlier with Universal. What the heck?
I don't know. I mean, I was a little surprised he said that, too. I get what he's saying. I'm sure that, you know, IMAX probably told him, yeah, don't worry, we've talked to the exhibitors, and there are some that are going to be a problem, as you probably...
Well, then he should be furious, because there's not one that's signed on yet. And
put it this way. This was a public statement, okay? You have no idea what the private phone call, and nor the decibel level of the private phone call that occurred between Richard Gelfond and Harvey Weinstein, because I'm sure if what he's saying is true, it was probably not a very pleasant phone call.
Well, who cares? But I mean, he says that they made the deal and they're happy because they now have a $60 million budget for this movie. So again, this is not some crappy little, and the implication there is that they wanted to bump up the budget. So it's not a question of, oh, they saw the movie, thought it sucked and wanted to sell it off to Netflix. You know, that's what the one argument is. Well, he says they wanted a bigger budget. They wanted to make the movie with a big budget and they made the deal. And so they were able to make it with a big budget. $60 million is not, you know, change. And now they can't show it in movie theaters in North America, the biggest market where that movie was made. You know, the biggest market for the original film, $110 million or whatever it made.
I would not be shocked if Netflix kind of backs off on this and says, you know what? We're getting into the motion picture distribution business, and we're going to distribute this to movie theaters. Where you can find Netflix everywhere now, and movie theaters at home. I would not be surprised if they kind of back down on this.
Why would they back down? They're not the ones who lose. It's the Weinsteins and IMAX.
Yeah, that's true.
They're not the ones to blink. They're like, screw you. We got a big movie. Yeah. Your argument is it would be more valuable to them as a debut on Netflix if it opened in theaters and made money and people actually liked it.
Yeah, and they probably don't want that kind of
risk.
Yeah, well, or that kind of mentality to perpetuate.
Right.
They would prefer that no, it's premiering on Netflix, and that
just like
in
on
and
HBO.
Of itself,
yeah, right. Yeah.
That in and of itself is a big deal.
Exactly. So I don't see why they would blink. But this to me, it was just a. I can't believe Harvey Weinstein got snookered. Like, they promised him, oh, we'll make sure it happens. Really? How could he not know that this would be a huge problem? He's a savvy producer. Anybody would know, trying to do a movie day and date on demand, or however you want to clarify it, while it's in a theater, is a big deal for a big movie.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, if anybody can explain Harvey Weinstein, they are probably doing quite well for themselves.
Well, no. I'm not explaining Harvey Weinstein. I'm just want to know the machinations of this deal. He's a smart man. I don't believe him when he says, oh, we thought they had it in hand. Well, I mean, I don't know what the true story is, but I bet it's juicy.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And Netflix is moving on into other territories. They made a deal in France. They tried to announce they were going into France. And people said, you're not going to get into France. It's so difficult. They have all these rules and regulations. Well, just a few months later, they've got a deal with Orange. And I don't know how to say this other company. Bouygues?
Yeah, Bouygues.
Bouygues, merci. And they've got a straight-to-streaming deal with the Weinsteins that includes two movies, Bill Murray's St. Vincent and The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, an art house film starring James McAvoy, I believe. Those movies are not going to debut in movie theaters. They're going to go right to Netflix in France, right?
Yes.
That means now, the end of the world, right? That means, oh my God, the sky's falling, right?
Yeah, much like the way many French movies do not play in movie theaters here, but go direct to Netflix and or other streaming video providers because they're not going to play in movie theaters. So St. Vincent may not actually, you know, have an audience in France beyond a certain amount. So why put it in theaters? The same for The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, which had two or three different edits between Toronto and Cannes.
Well, don't make it sound like that was the purposeful. There were three different films. There was the film from one point of view, a film from the other point of view, and a film that combined them. It wasn't like a desperate attempt to try and make something happen. That was the artistic decision to have three different versions of the film.
Okay, and that's The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby that we're talking
about. That's right, yeah.
Jessica Chastain and James Mack. Okay.
Right, so, and I have not seen it in any version, though it sounds interesting. But yes, as you say, it's an art house project with perhaps not big commercial possibilities that didn't do well here. And they said, well, we're not going to, you know, Bill Murray's not setting it on fire here in North America. Let's just, you know, get money by doing it to Netflix.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, you know, the idea that this is they're upending the world, that would be like saying, oh, the AMC, American Movie Guide, they're being carried by Orange. Okay. It's a channel. Just like Netflix is, and they bought the rights to show the HBO movie Behind the Candelabra. It's not going to play in theaters in France. It's going to go right to AMC. Well, all right, that happens. You know, some movies get in theaters, some debut on TV, some go straight to DVD.
Well,
right?
And you have to look at the Weinstein Company in this instance with St. Vincent and The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. Those are products to them. They own those products, and they have to sell those products around the world or in the territories for which they control. They have to find a distribution channel to do that, and they have to find the most profitable distribution channel. And they are looking at France and saying, well, we could release it in theaters and make X.
Or we could sell it to someone to buy it in theaters, more likely. They're not going to they're going to probably sell it to the local people, right?
It depends. Sometimes, yeah. Or they can distribute it through Netflix, own a larger percentage, because as you point out, they might sell it to somebody else. They could own a larger percentage and make X plus Y. Well, X plus Y is more than just X, so let's give it to Netflix where we'll earn X plus Y.
Yeah, I'm surprised with Bill Murray. I would figure he's a good draw in France. I'm sure they like the Jim Jarmusch. And, you know, he's obviously a big star, a big name. And this type of project might, I would think, appeal more in France than, say, some generic big movie. But certainly The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, you can understand what's going on. Said they got a lot of players all over the world. Everybody wants to make money. Everybody wants to sell their product. Netflix is just one more company willing to buy your movie.
You know who is also one more company willing to buy your movie?
No.
Alibaba. Do you know who Alibaba is?
I love the name. It's like the Amazon of China.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yes. And actually, I mean, I had been using this website years and years ago starting, I want to say.
You buy from Alibaba?
Well, for certain projects, I would have to buy from Alibaba because I was buying raw material or pieces of the project, different material. And it was a place where you could go and buy from all these manufacturers and vendors in China, but you'd buy like parts or you'd buy like, you know, oh, gee, I have to print 400 t-shirts. You could buy the t-shirts. And they print whatever you want. So it was a way to find, it was like a sourcing website. But now it's turned into this big giant e-commerce website.
That's right. And it's based in China and it's founded by billionaire Jack Ma. I suppose he became a billionaire with Alibaba.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes. And great name. He realized that people all over the world knew the tale of Alibaba and the 30 fees. You know, every culture knows Alibaba. I thought, well, I wish I thought of that name for my website. Alibaba is just a great name, especially for the type of website it is, like Amazon. I remember when Amazon came, I'm like, it's a river? I don't get it. So what's Alibaba doing?
Well, Jack Ma is coming to Hollywood. Actually, this week, he's in Hollywood. He's meeting with all of the big players, i.e.
Oh, when are we meeting him?
The studios. You know what? He told us he'd get back to us. He has to work out his schedule with Fox first.
Okay.
Yeah. Something about don't call us, we'll call something.
So what's he doing? What's he want to buy?
He wants to buy content. He has a video streaming service, much like Netflix, but in the and much like YouTube, but in
China. And much like Amazon Prime.
Yes, and he is basically saying, hey, we've got all this Chinese content. You know what we really need, given the fact that this Hollywood content that you're selling is so popular in the movie theaters? We need more of your content to put on our services and to stream to our millions and millions of customers.
He wants to buy a chunk of Lionsgate.
Well, and that's separate, by the way. By the way, you know who broke this story? Your old stomping grounds, the New York Post.
Oh, well, there you go.
They broke this story that he wants to buy 37.4% of Lionsgate, which, you know, you may know them as the studio behind The Hunger Games. And they bought Summit, which was the studio behind Twilight. 37.4%, that's a big chunk of that company.
I wonder what that would be. That would be about
$1.6 billion.
Okay, so is he buying out the chairman?
No, I think he's buying an investor. Remember, some time ago, there was this whole to-do with Carl Icahn, the activist investor, trying to like...
Mark Wachowski is the chairman, and he owns 37.4%.
Well,
his stake
is
worth $1.6 billion. So is he buying that?
Yes.
So he's leaving, and he wants to cash out. And they are ready to cash in because Alibaba went public for $25 billion with their record-setting IPO. And they've got money to spend.
Yeah,
and so like, hey, we'll take a chunk of Lionsgate. Come right up.
I think they have about $16 billion in cash left over from that IPO.
Oh, that's a big couch.
Yeah, I'd say so. Now, what I will say is people are saying, well, does this deal make sense? And in a way it does, because right now there is this quota, as we mentioned, of films going from Hollywood into China. There's 34 films per year. And most of them have to be 3D or IMAX. You know, they have to be the big blockbusters.
Well, they've added 10 movies that are going to be art housey things just to sort of placate Westerners, right? They're going to add.
And by Westerners, we mean Europeans, because they couldn't get any films shown there because all Hollywood took up all the 34 slots.
Right. So they're going to have some smaller movies that just to keep people quiet and say, oh, no, we're opening the gate wider. But really, as far as the big blockbuster movies, they're not budging much on that.
Right.
And they do have two companies that are going to be bidding to distribute movies. It used to be one government controlled one. Now there may be two. But there's no indication that they're adding to the number of films that they're going to display.
That's right. China Film Group is the big distributor over there. Of course, state owned and state run. And one way to get your film in under the quota or over the quota in
a way. Or to try.
Yes, is to be partly Chinese owned or to have a Chinese co-production. And that's what a lot of people, at least in Hollywood, are saying, gee, this could actually work quite well because Lionsgate will have a road into China.
Yeah, but it doesn't work.
Why is that?
It's no guarantee that your movie is going to get in. Well, everybody's trying to partner with Chinese companies. It still doesn't guarantee that your movie is going to get picked up for distribution there. So I don't understand. Alibaba has no magic ability to say, we're going to make this happen. They're a big player. They got a lot of money. They presumably have a lot of influence, but they have no magic key.
Yes. Well, that's true. And I think as many stories about this deal pointed out, there is a history of scuttled deals between U.S. entertainment companies and China and Chinese companies. So, you know, there's never really any assurances when dealing in China. And that's what these stories were trying to point out. Hey, this could work, but it could also blow up, or it could also just be
a whole lot of frustration. Be a deal that makes sense, not doing the deal because you think somehow magically it's going to get you into Chinese distribution. It needs to make sense for its own reasons, not for the reasons that they... Just like IMAX saying, no, we can get your movie shown in theaters. Don't worry about it. It needs to make sense for the deal that you're doing, not for what they promise you. We can do this too. Don't trust us.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the hope, at least on Lionsgate end, is, well, maybe we can actually get more money out of China, legitimately get more money out of China and not, have
some
of it.
How does partnering with Alibaba work around the 25% rule? Because in China, as in many countries overseas, there's a limit to how much money you can take out of the country. So, or I should say, there's a percentage that you get from the box office that is roughly about 25% for China. England isn't that much higher, right?
Right.
The UK. So, yeah, so let's not throw stones at China. A lot of countries are much lower than the US, which is 50%. When you release a movie in America, if it grosses $100 million, the theaters keep $50 million and the studio gets $50
million. Roughly, yeah. Most of the time. Yeah.
Right.
I think in China right now, they're trying to crack down on all this corruption. Specifically, they're trying to crack down on box office fraud. So I think part of the thinking might be, and this is purely my speculation, gee, if we're with someone from China, maybe we'll get more honest box office returns, and thus the box office will be larger, and thus our 25% be bigger.
I think basically the thinking goes to, you want to give us $1.6 billion to have a piece of our company? Go right ahead.
Yeah, especially since the chairman, as you point out, Mark Reshesky, he wants out. So
and they're not going to control anything. They're not going to whatever. They're going to obviously want deals, but this doesn't give them anything. It just gives them stock, piece of the company. I mean, obviously they want to have a say and influence and talk, but it doesn't give them control of anything, right? They'll be the single largest shareholder, but they will not have a controlling of the company, right?
Yeah. Well, at board meetings, they wouldn't have much control. They would have more psychological influence, I suppose, and financial influence, because if you start shedding shares of Lionsgate, you could actually drive the stock into the ground. But
and if you buy $1.6 billion, I guess you probably get to put someone on the board.
Yes.
You might say, hey, we'd like to put someone on the board, please.
Exactly.
Jack Ma says, my nephew, Joey Ma, he'd like to be on the board. Thank you.
Well, Mark Reshesky, the reason he owns 37.4% and is the chairman now is because of the whole Carl Icahn thing that I just mentioned, where Icahn wanted to try and break up the company and do all sorts of things with the company, and he failed, so he just jettisoned his stock. So Reshesky, actually, he bought all this stock, $350 million. He's going to be making a windfall here at $1.6 billion if this deal goes through.
His stock has increased five times?
Well, yeah, that's what they're saying, and they being the newspapers. LA Times, Variety.
You're saying he bought this stock at $350 million, and now it's valued at 1.6?
Yes. He has $350 million in to this stock, so he's laid out $350 million. It is now, if this deal goes through, it would be at a $1.6 billion valuation.
And he's buying it from Reshesky.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Well, that sounds like a big deal.
Oh, if that sounds like a big deal, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, it's about The View. Barbara Walters' innovative chat fest, The View, is struggling in the ratings. She's no longer with it. A complete overhaul and new host brought a lot of eyeballs to the veteran daytime talker, but it's been downhill ever since. We've got Whoopi Goldberg, Rosie O'Donnell, Rosie Perez, and token conservative Nicole Wallace. They're all still working on their chemistry on the new revamped show. The show's been trending down in key demographics for years, and in a horse race with carbon copy upstart The Talk, it's reaching 2.8 million viewers, a number that will keep it afloat, but the ratings are not really moving in the right direction. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, it's a valuable property. They've revamped it completely. It's not setting the world on fire. It's still trending downward. So it's not a good day for the people at The View.
Well, this next story, you might recall how U2 had this new album that they forced everybody to listen to.
Those bastards.
Yeah, well, a deluxe version with two new tracks, two remixes, and six acoustic versions of songs on the album was released. 27,000 CDs were sold and 1,500 versions on vinyl. Some 26 million people, by the way, have downloaded the album, and 81 million people listened to at least part of it, according to iTunes, and it's number 9 on Billboard's chart. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm surprised how few people bought it on vinyl.
Why is that?
Like, just 1,600, 1,500 copies on vinyl. I thought that would be bigger. You're kind of amused that anybody bought it digitally. That just seems insane. But CDs, I guess, there's still people like me who like their CDs. So it's not a big deal. You give away an album for free, you're not going to sell a lot of copies.
Well, I actually ran down to the record store to buy it on vinyl, but then realized there was no record store.
That's right. Though there is a great music museum in New York. All the record stores have disappeared practically. There's a few little used ones hanging around. But there is the Louis Armstrong Museum, which you talked about in the show notes.
Yeah, no, I was actually fascinated by this story, being a trumpet player myself. Being a lapsed trumpet player. Apparently, babies don't like trumpets. They're really loud. Both the babies and the trumpets. But Louis Armstrong lived in Queens, which is a borough of New York. He lived there for 28 years, the last 28 years of his life, and he befriended this fan, Jack Bradley, who was a sailor, but he was also an aficionado of Louis Armstrong, the jazz trumpet player.
He owned a club at one point. He was even a manager of jazz artists. So, yeah, he was a real big jazz, lover.
And he is said to be the world's largest collector of Armstrongiana. I don't know what that, I think they made that word up there in the New York Times, but Armstrong memorabilia, basically.
Yeah, I haven't been there yet, but the Louis Armstrong House Museum is a nice little, it's just a fun little thing. It's not a great museum, it's just where he lived. And the fun thing is you can play audio recordings on certain days, because he kept a diary, an audio diary, all his life, you know, as an adult. Carried around a tape recorder back when that was unusual, and recorded his daily comments and thoughts and things. And you can just say, play me May 2nd, 1984, and they'll cue it up and play it. I mean, you know, one of your group gets to do it. So I've been in the museum. It's a fun little place. If you're really into Louis Armstrong, it's cool. And now, I haven't seen this, but they've got a whole exhibit of this stuff from Jack Bradley. I'm kind of fascinated.
And yeah, he had, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of records and pictures, like some unbelievable number of pictures, including one with Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis together.
Well, sure, of course. And so, they didn't always get along.
Right.
Miles was like, oh, you're Uncle Tom. And Louis Armstrong's like, screw you.
Right.
But we're checking out. I'm sure you two were fans.
Of Louis Armstrong.
Of course. And okay. Miles Davis. But yeah, of course. I meant Louis Armstrong.
Okay.
And of course, U2 was on Broadway, but they're not anymore now that Spider-Man closed, but something else is coming.
And I'm sure Larry Mullen Jr. and Adam Clayton would say, U2 wasn't on Broadway. The Edge and Bono were on Broadway, okay? Do not confuse the two.
Fair enough.
Puppets on Broadway? How sweet! That may be the reaction of people who hear about the Broadway-bound play Hand to God, as they remember the amusingly naughty musical Avenue Q, or their favorite Moominchance production. Not so fast.
Moominchance again.
Moominchance! I remember as a kid, there would be commercials on like the reruns in the afternoon of like the Brady Bunch of the latest Moominchance production.
I do too. But, I never saw them, but I remember the ads.
And they're still going strong, by the way. Yeah, they're like a mime troupe.
Yes.
But not so fast. Hand to God will make one of the boldest leaps to Broadway in ages when it begins previews in March. First off, it's an original play. It's not based on a book or a movie or a TV show or anything. Frankly, apparently the playwright just kind of like got a pencil and a piece of paper. He just made it up.
Crazy.
The actors in it have won raves for the two times it was mounted off Broadway. And then before that off Broadway. But they're this thing that is referred to as not famous, not a movie or TV or even a reality show bold face among them. In fact, plus it's a foul mouthed black comedy about a teenager whose hand puppet gets possessed by the devil that does not end with some comforting religious bromides. The producers of the $3 million production are embracing their rebel status with an ad campaign that says simply in horror movie lettering, no movie stars, no London transfer, no film adaptation, ... Pray for us. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, sadly, it's a big whoop. You know, it's just so sad. It's not a trend. It's not sparking a wave of fresh new plays coming to Broadway. It's sad that we can make such a big noise about one play that's not based on a movie coming to Broadway. But I'm excited. I really like the show. I saw both times in both levels where it was at before. The star, Stephen Boyer, is definitely going to get a Tony nomination for Best Actor. And frankly, he's, you know, a front runner, as far as I'm concerned, for Best Actor period, which is crazy because, you know, we got all the spring to get through. And the show will get nominated for Best Play, unquestionably. So I'm happy for the show. I'm excited. I hope that this risk pays off. I don't know if it's paying off for Sting. You know, we talked about Bono and The Edge being on Broadway. Sting opened up on Broadway just a few nights ago. A new musical that he wrote songs for called The Last Ship opened. It got very politely negative reviews. Everyone said, oh, it's earnest. It means well. Some of his songs are quite good, but apparently it's rather dull.
Yes, you know when critics are saying your show is not a disaster, that actually, you know, it's not good. And when they're saying there's a reason the word last is in the name of the show.
Oh, no. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm seeing it on Wednesday. I like Sting a lot, so we'll see how it is.
You know, actually, I saw a play, which I'm pretty sure you saw as well. It made its way out to Los Angeles, which is a little surprising. I did not think it would. Trip to Bountiful, which is, I guess, a revival.
Yes, it's a Horton Foote play and turned into an Oscar-winning film. I think it was a TV movie first, actually, now that I think about it. So, yes, it's a play by a great playwright, Horton Foote. It was this production that you saw was with Cicely Tyson. And so it was an all-black cast. It was a reimagining of the play, seamlessly done. And it was a lot of fun on Broadway. Yes. I'm not sure who else was in the cast, but Cicely Tyson was a lot of, it was a hoot.
Blair Underwood and Vanessa Williams.
Oh, well, Vanessa Williams continued it. And I think Blair Underwood replaced Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah, and it was good. I mean, it was really, I walked out of there thinking it was one of the best plays and best productions I've seen in a long time.
Well, you need to come to Broadway, but I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, Broadway's a little far. The N train doesn't stop this far out west.
No, it's a good play. It's not a great play, but it was a fun production. I did like the movie quite a bit. It's not his best, but it's an affecting work.
Well, here's my question. How big is the pie?
What pie?
Well, Hollywood studios love to boast about box office, but they totally clam up when it comes time for all these other sources of income to be talked about. You practically need a court order to see what studios raked in from Blu-ray, DVD sales, and rentals. Actually, you do need a court order, in fact. You don't practically need one, you do. Now the same is proving true from streaming video on demand, SVOD, and all their other sources of loot, like cable and TV and satellite syndication and on demand and sales of US TV shows into foreign markets, which, by the way, is something you virtually never hear being discussed. Though, how massively profitable must a franchise like CSI be around the world? I mean, every time I'm in France, there is CSI in French on the television. And the pie, by the way, this pie that we're talking about, it's getting bigger. One analyst claims that Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon alone will spend $6.8 billion on programming around the world in 2015. That's a big leap from the $5.2 billion those three players spent in 2014. Some of this, by the way, is based on them producing original programming, not them licensing programming. The vast majority is paying studios for the rights to stream their TV shows and movies. Plus, there's the $18.4 billion that studios expect to pull in from domestic syndication on cable and satellite, just to name one or two other bounties that they collect. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, my head is spinning. There's a lot of money out there.
I just tried to throw so many numbers at you. I was waiting to hear the popping sound at the other end.
There's a lot of money out there. But those three companies alone are spending, we assume worldwide, $6.8 billion on programming. Now, Netflix, for example, pays like $300 million for original programming. So most of their money is spent on buying rights to TV shows and movies. It's a lot of money. I wish I knew how much it was. I wish I knew. Is it making up for slowing sales of DVD and Blu-ray? How is digital downloads doing? How is video on demand? We don't know. We never see figures. They never talk about it.
Yeah, unlike music, which can't stop talking about it. Because in music, there's, oh gosh, we're getting pennies in digital dimes instead of all of these analog dollars that we used to get.
That's right. They're not making money and they're bitching. When they make money, they keep it quiet.
That's right. And you know they're making money when you don't hear anything. Well, you know, actually, I want to point out Michael Wolff in The Hollywood Reporter wrote a great piece about the whole HBO CBS direct-to-consumer streaming thing and about mm-hmm. how he said, look, I don't understand what the big deal is, okay? Because much, Michael, like you're pointing out, hey, look, you've got Netflix and Amazon Prime. These are all companies that are now customers who are willing to give you money to make content. These are new customers for you. And, oh, by the way, they're disrupting the digital world. TV is disrupting the internet is the title of the article. It's worth reading.
Right. Instead of saying that Netflix is throwing a wrench into how Hollywood and TV works, no. TV and Hollywood are conquering the internet.
Right.
These companies all say, you know what we need? We need original content, which we need to pay Hollywood producers to make, or we need to refurbish old episodes of Friends. You know, we need content and we need stuff and we're going to make some of our own, but we also, and that means we need all the talent already out there in Hollywood and TV land, or we need to pay for what you've already created.
Right. And, you know, he goes on to point out, well, let's see, I could give my stuff to Comcast if I'm HBO and get $6 per subscriber because, you know, Comcast wants the other $6. Or I could go direct to the consumer, which everybody says is going to cannibalize my cable business. But if I go direct to the consumer, then I get a subscriber that I have a direct relationship with, and Oh, by the way, I get to keep the full $12. Yeah, I'm okay with cannibalizing my cable business because they get more money per subscriber.
Yes, but though, of course, the person with cable who's going to, you know, quit their cable and then get it isn't the same. I mean, they're not going to quit their cable HBO subscription and get it direct when they still have to pay for cable and internet.
Right.
So you're talking about people who cut the cord, which isn't as many as you would think.
Well, Michael, you know, do you live in the Bronx and like to read? Tough. The New York City borough of 1.4 million people is about to lose its last bookstore. Barnes & Noble is shutting down by the end of the year after its landlord jacked up the rent beyond what the once powerful mega chain could pay. It's the latest New York Barnes & Noble location to close. They shut down their Fifth Avenue flagship location in January and the huge Upper West Side location before that. In the Bronx, residents saw the last independent bookstore. It was called Books in the Hood. That shut down in 2011. They have some specialty stores focused on comics and religious work, Spanish language and the like, but no general interest bookstore. We've heard of food deserts. Now, we need to start thinking about book deserts. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I like the idea of a book desert. It's true.
And it's not book dessert. You're not eating the book, okay?
No, that's different. That's totally different. This is a big deal, but wait.
Wait, what?
Last minute news means a deal was extended. They've extended the lease for 2 more years with no rent increase, and that was only after Bronx politicians intervened. The story made big national news. It was on the front page of the New York Times. So you know what? I mean, that's great. I'm glad the store is in place for at least another 2 years. They didn't jack up their rent. They're trying to make a bigger deal for long term. That's great. But you know what? It's sort of good news, bad news. It's like it only happened because it was the last one and there was an outcry and everybody in the borough weighed in and pressured the landlord and, you know, strong-armed people. It's kind of like when a new bookstore opens and you find out, oh, they had a Kickstarter campaign and asked everybody to come in and help put stuff on the shelves. It's like, is this a bookstore or a charity? You know, so I'm glad it's there, but it's sad that it's just really because of its symbolic status as the last bookstore. There should be more than one bookstore in a borough of 1.4 million people. So I'm glad it's still there, but the overall picture is very sad.
You know, the irony is in Carbondale, Illinois, a city that I visited recently, there is a Barnes & Noble, and the population of Carbondale, Illinois, albeit one with a university in it, is 25,000 people.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, because it's a college town, that's just big enough to handle. Is that 25,000 including the students?
It's, I think 50,000 tops with the students.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. So I forget what the figures are, but to, you know, be able to support a chain, and when it's a college town, you've got a lot more people who are probably of the young book buying age, and so it's, you know, the numbers work better to your advantage. But yeah, you need a certain amount of size in order to support a superstore. Maybe it's not a superstore. Maybe it was a little smaller. You know, I don't know what the size of this particular location was. But yeah, that's, you know, this. You know, you can't have a town of 5,000. They're not going to support a big bookstore. But yeah, when you get up to 50,000, 100,000 people, you've got enough mass and community that you can afford it. And so a borough of 1.4 million people, oh my God.
Well, you know, I think that the landlord just kind of looked at his tenant list, his or her tenant list.
He can make more money.
And said, Barnes & Noble's a bookstore? Oh, I thought they were a law firm.
Yeah, but I see this in Long Island City, Queens. I mean, there was a restaurant that was in our neighborhood for ages. The landlord just kept jacking up the rent. She had to quit. She was making money. She was surviving. But he wanted rent so much more than what she could pay. And that's why these businesses are going out of business. And we're getting another, you know, CVS.
Yeah. Well, and the same thing is happening here in Los Angeles. The Cat and the Fiddle is a pub where jazz musicians play every Sunday night. And it's a British pub. And after 30 years, they're shutting down because the landlord jacked up the rent. It's right there on Sunset Boulevard at a nice little spot, kind of good proximity to many different venues. And it's becoming a hipper part of town. Sure enough, they're going to probably put a chain in of some kind.
Bummer.
Now, the Ken Burns documentary about the Roosevelts, Teddy, Franklin, and Eleanor, was, of course, a big deal for PBS. Any Ken Burns project always is. But this was a huge success. The miniseries was seen in part, or whole, by some 33 million people, with the entire 7-part series averaging more than 9 million viewers, which would rank it solidly in the top 30 for all of prime time, depending on the competition the week it aired. It was the most watched week of programming on PBS in 20 years. What aired 20 years ago? The Ken Burns documentary, Baseball. Great documentary, by the way. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal. I mean, there's a lot more Ken Burns documentaries coming to PBS.
Yeah.
But you know what? Again, like TV ratings are so messed up. You know, this is like weeks after this thing aired that they're finally getting the word out about how what a big rating success it was. You can't have overnights real quick, but my God, they're just burying the news about people watching television and to what degree. I mean, I knew. I mean, my mother, other people, there were a lot of people when this show was airing, they said, hey, have you watched this? God, the Eleanor Roosevelt one was really good. I mean, I got a lot of feedback that I normally don't get for any television show. And so I sensed that it was probably a big deal. And I've been talking to USA. I'm not talking to USA. I mean, I sent an email to USA Today once, and I'm going to send them another one saying, you know, why don't you revamp your entire TV rating section? You know, it seems to me that the whole thing is broken. Listing shows for like what day of the week they air, what time, against what. That just seems so not germane anymore. If you were going to redo TV ratings from the ground up, you know, you wouldn't separate primetime from cable. I mean, I should say you wouldn't separate network from cable. You wouldn't separate. You know, you wouldn't start to give ratings only based on, you know, overnight ratings. You'd wait till you had all the data in, right? You wait a week, list all the shows for the week, and, you know, number one to number 50. There you go. I mean, that's the way to do it. Whether number two is AMC's The Walking Dead, and number four is HBO's movie, and number seven is an FX thing, and number five is ESPN football, and number nine, you know, whatever. But I just think this whole system is so completely broken, they really have to rethink everything.
Well, and keep in mind, we live in a society where on Friday they're already calling box office figures for movies. So
that's a much more predictable, and that's a much more predictable and accurate barometer. They don't have to go back 3 weeks later and say, oh, did we say that movie grossed $30 million? We meant $57 million.
Well,
and
what I'm referring to
The Walking Dead, they're announcing with great fanfare that 15 or 14 million people watch it, and 2 months later we find out it was actually 28 million people. We're like, well, that's a big difference.
I guess what I'm referring to is the mentality of the instant gratification, and, you know, everybody wants to know everything instantly.
Yes, but when, and that's true, and that's what people keep telling me. And they say, well, people want to know right away. It's like, well, but they can't know before it's watched. you know, if a show, nobody even cares when a show debuts. My brother watches The Big Bang Theory, right? He didn't even realize it had moved to Monday nights. What does he care? He turns on his TV, he looks at the list, and there, when a new episode of Big Bang Theory is there, he watches it. He doesn't know what night it technically airs. Monday, now it's moving back to Thursday. He doesn't know. He doesn't care. He turns on his TV and he watches the show. And so when a show debuts like The Good Wife on Sunday night, and then you have the weekly ratings that air that Wednesday, that's when the big chart comes in on USA Today, right? That's it. You've got live. You don't even have live plus three because, frankly, it's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. So they're announcing ratings for shows that are still being watched.
Right.
And I'm not talking about now into all eternity. I'm just saying live plus seven is the standard, right? I mean, live plus three at least is what advertisers pay for. And those ratings that they include in their chart aren't including live plus three. You got to wait a week. You can't give a figure until the baseball game is over. You can't give ratings, you know, overnight, 3 days later. It's pointless. People are still watching it. And you can't effectively extrapolate the way you do from Friday box office. If you could do that predictably, that would be fine. But as we see every year, these patterns keep changing. And I think they just need to say, well, why are we announcing these figures overnight? Let's wait a week.
I can tell you why. And this is a phrase often heard in business, because that's the way we've always done it. Now, speaking of television, cable channel TLC has canceled its once red-hot reality series, Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. Since the show has faded from the national spotlight, its peak came in 2012, by the way, you could say it was an easy call for TLC after news reports claimed the divorcing mom on the show was dating a registered sex offender. So she's like a real catch, I suppose.
She says that's not true.
Yeah, well, but, you know, new episodes were set for January, and it's not like TLC is brimming with smash hits, so the decision is still significant. The mother claimed on Facebook, as you say, Michael, that the TMZ story was completely untrue. No word yet from Honey Boo Boo, while TLC says the health and welfare of, quote unquote, these remarkable children, and that's the end of that quote, is their only priority. And by only priority, we mean if they're not healthy and able to star in our reality shows, we have no show. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Yeah, if you're really worried about their health and welfare, you wouldn't make a reality show about somebody. That's pretty much true, right?
Yes.
it's a big whoop. It's just, you know, as somebody said, when you do TV with reality show stars whose whole purpose is to be provocative, you cannot be shocked and offended when they are provocative and crazy and do things that are dumb. You know, but it's unpleasant. It's unhappy. Let's hope all the children are safe. And God bless Honey Boo Boo.
The Yanks are coming. The Yanks are coming. And not the kind you like, Michael, like those, you know, New York Yankees.
No.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not exactly the Yanks, but the U.S. cable channel AMC, which is home of The Walking Dead and Mad Men, they have bought a 49.9% stake in BBC America. Parent company, the BBC, maintains that sliver of control over its progeny, but they believe with AMC's help, they can do a more efficient job selling ads and garnering higher fees from cable providers. And by more efficient, of course, we mean cheaper. Big deal or big whoop?
Congratulations, BBC America. Everybody's fired.
Yes. I mean, I guess.
Yes.
There will be.
That's exactly what it means.
Redundancies are in the works.
Oh, God. Oh, well.
The Comedy Central hit duo Key and Pele. Is it Pele or Peel? Key and Peel.
Key and Peel.
Okay.
Pele. Clearly you're not watching this show.
I do, actually. It's great.
I wouldn't say great, but really? Then how do you not know it's Key and Peele?
I don't know, because I've never really paid attention to their, you know, the names.
Okay.
I couldn't even tell you which one is which.
Is this a play on their, like, racist teacher sketch?
No.
You know, where the black teacher mispronounces all the white kids' names? You know, it's very funny. It's one of their best sketches. But anyway, keep going.
Well, it turns out they are headed to the movies. First, they're producing a reboot of the Police Academy series, which makes sense, actually, for them to do that.
Does it?
Well,
it doesn't make sense for anybody to reboot the Police Academy series other than they want to make money.
Well, it's not exactly pushing the envelope with any Dave Chappelle-style humor, are they? If that doesn't really sound tepid enough, as Michael just pointed out, they now plan to also make Keanu, a comedy centered around a kidnapped cat, not a kidnapped action star actor. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop based on the projects. Good Lord. I mean, these guys are very hot names in TV. I think they're a little overrated. You know, they seem amiable enough guys. They're not Dave Chappelle, that's for damn sure. But, you know, these are their two big movie projects. Good Lord.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, it's all in the execution.
Anything can be funny.
Yeah.
That's right.
including mispronouncing their names.
That's right.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, we're discussing a story that Michael, in no uncertain terms, he wrote in the show notes, "I understand not a word of this."
That's right. It's Sperling in his tech glory, right? So, but you just did a good job. You went to a conference. What is the CMPTE?
He not only does not understand a word of it, he just got the acronym wrong. So it's the
CMSMPTE.
SMPTE is the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. These are the guys that get together and they create standards for how broadcast television should work and radio should work
and film.
Yeah, it's mostly television and film, and how, you know, for surround sound or digital cinema or a broadcast standard, they'll write it out, and then it goes through the ISO and it goes through other bodies. But basically, it's saying, hey, everybody, this is their way we're going to broadcast television or distribute movies. You can build your equipment to these standards and the content should play.
That's right. And so you guys get to geek out about all these things that are coming down the road in the future, some of which pan out, some of which never do, some of which become a reality but never catch fire, etc. Like laser projection. What is laser projection?
Laser projection is, rather than use a bulb, which is what's done now, a xenon bulb, big, bright, hot.
And they wear out quick, and so theater owners don't even like to use them, and therefore the projection sucks because they don't use the proper bulb, blah, blah, blah.
Well, yeah, they don't. It's that they use the proper bulb. They just kind of turn it down a bit. Let's just dim it just a bit, because if I do that, it'll last an extra week or two.
Right. So what does laser projection do?
Laser projection uses, right now, it's about 6 colors, and it's way brighter, and it lasts way longer and costs way more. So, you know,
you almost had me there.
Yeah, it's like, wow, well, that sounds great. Yes, there's only a bit of a problem. It's great for 3D because the images pop right off the screen the way they should. And, you know, without that kind of dull grayish look to them, there's a little bit of a speckle problem. So that's one issue. And
a little bit of a speckle problem.
Yeah, you really have to know what you're looking for to see the speckling on screen. And there's,
but that would affect people subconsciously. It's not a good thing.
Yeah, not a good thing. But they've almost got that down. There's the other issue is the light that is produced by these laser projectors. People view different colors or the same color differently. So you might say it's green. I might say, well, it's more like forest green or almost an aqua. Laser kind of accentuates that.
It
brings that out because
it's so vivid.
Yes.
So this is how far away in the future? We don't care. This is strictly for theater owners, right?
Yes. This is being done now. I mean, I would say by the middle of next year, you probably wouldn't buy a projector and say, yeah, give me the xenon bulb version. You'd probably say, okay.
Even though it's that much more expensive?
Yeah, probably, because the manufacturers are probably going to stop making projectors that don't feature laser, except for maybe Sony. Maybe Sony will keep making xenon projectors until they perfect their lasers. But
they're going to be using that feature right away,
right?
The laser projection, right? So it's not like consumers where if we buy a new TV today, it's probably going to be 3D compatible, even though I personally am never going to sit in my home and watch 3D programming with stupid big glasses on.
Right. And the reason it's 3D compatible is because it can show 120 hertz. And think of it this way. Instead of 120 hertz, think of it as 120 frames per second. Okay. So right now, movies shoot at what? 24 frames per second.
No.
Unless you're The Hobbit, in which case you shoot at 48 frames per second.
Right.
And you get, so what the television is showing you is roughly 30 frames per second, although it's set now for 60 frames per second.
This is what I want to show. This is where you make my head hurt. I don't want to think about any of that. All I want to think is it's 3D compatible, but I don't care.
Yeah, that's fine. You don't have to care.
Now, either these theater owners who are buying new projection systems, these are like the last people on board, right? Because everybody's been converting to digital projection because studios are not releasing films in celluloid anymore. You have to have a digital projector, right?
Don't tell that to Paramount Pictures.
Well, but to 98, but yeah, they lugged out some old celluloid projectors just for, you know,
Christopher Nolan.
Yes. But basically everybody has converted to digital, right?
Yes. Everybody has converted to digital. And so if you're getting a laser projector, you're either retrofitting your existing projector, which sometimes can't be done, or you're doing a refresh where you're buying a new projector, which is unfortunately for theater owners happening more frequently than they used to with celluloid. It used to be like, I could keep a projector for 30 years and it's still the same thing.
Did they actually keep a projector for decades? They did, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So this is a new thing. All the filmmakers, you know, James Cameron said, you guys need to convert to digital. George Lucas, you better convert to digital. We need digital. So now theater owners spend all this money converting to digital, and now they're finding out that there are all these things, not just stuff that'll be nice once they happen, like laser projection, but other new features and formats that they're going to want to have, and directors are going to say, you got to show this to show my movie. There are all these little features and doodads coming up down the road that they're going to need to update their projectors a lot more often than they ever used to before.
Yeah, and sometimes it's just a simple software upgrade or a little piece of a...
Well, but no, you know, that's fine. But we're talking about having to buy a new projector and invest lots of money. They just spent a ton of money converting, and now you go to this conference, people say, oh, we need HDR, we need 8K, we need this, we need that, we need the other thing. And they're going to find out a lot of pressure from filmmakers and studios to upgrade their projectors every 10 years, every 5 years. How often?
Well, I mean, think about it this way. What is the cell phone you're using today as opposed to 5 years ago? Same thing with your computer. What computer were you using 5 years ago?
Well, I don't replace my TV as often as I replace my cell phone. And I held onto my cell phone as long as possible, which was 3 years before I had to replace it with a new one. Some people do it every year. I like to wait as long as possible. My TV, I replaced every 10 years. My car, I might replace every 10 or 12 years. You know, it depends on what the product is, how expensive it is, and how long it's doing what I need it to do. So if you've got your celluloid projector, there's no reason you would buy another one every 10 years because you didn't need it. And it's expensive. But now suddenly theater owners are looking at a big new expense on their bottom line, aren't they?
Yes. Well, especially for things like, well, first of all, 4K, maybe... You know, maybe you don't need it in a specific...
What's 4K? 4K is just the next stage in high definition, right? That's an easy way to think about it. But you explained to me there's this other format called HDR. I don't know if format's the right word. Maybe standard is. But you compared these two in a pretty nice way because they're both supposed to be steps forward in quality. And as far as most people say, 4K is, it's better. You can see, but it doesn't drive you crazy with the light, whereas HDR, which is high dynamic range, that actually really is a big leap forward. And so explain to people the difference between 4K and HDR.
Well, with 4K, it's like, okay, instead of 2K, you're getting where you get 2 million pixels. Okay, you get 4K, you get 4 million pixels. So it's more pixels to make
that
the image
great.
That make the image sharper. Okay.
And 8K is already coming up down the road, isn't it?
Yes. But the problem is, now, the funny thing is, they actually showed NHK's display at NAB this year. So NHK is a...
NHK at NAB. Don't say that. Somebody showed a 4K display.
No, an 8K display.
Okay, an 8K display, yes. And?
The pixels were so tight together that they actually said the optimum viewing distance, and they had, like, the monitor on the wall, and then... like these little footprints where you were supposed to stand for the optimal viewing. I thought, yeah, nobody's going to stand that close to a television set. I'm sorry.
How big was the monitor?
It was pretty, you know, probably 72 inches.
Oh, so it was a big TV screen, and they wanted you to be how close?
Like probably a foot and a half away.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah, and I thought, if you have to be that close for it to be viewable, then 4K or 2K will be just fine.
And if you stood backwards and not in that particular spot, how did it look?
It looked fine. It looked good. You could tell, you know, it looked sharper. But the reality is the difference between 4K and 8K, your eye, the naked eye, could not tell.
Is the difference between 4K and Blu-ray that important?
That's a loaded question, but...
Okay. So
But you asked about HDR. So
right.
4K,
what's the difference? 4K
is
twice as much as 2K, which is what we have now, or a lot of people have now.
Yeah, twice as many pixels. And mm-hmm. you see 4K all over the place. You go to some of these theaters, they say, we have 4K projectors.
Yes.
The question is, do you have 4K content? Because you don't. Nothing is being distributed in 4K. Very little is being distributed in 4K. High dynamic range is basically taking content or shooting content with more information. So when you're shooting it, you're actually capturing more information. So instead of there being, let's say, 6 tones of gray, there'll be 32 tones of gray. So you get richer colors, more vibrant colors, more accurate colors. You get a true black and a true white, brighter
white. So is this a new software that you need to put onto your high def cameras, or is this an entirely new format where you need an entirely new high definition camera, or what do you need to do to capture HDR?
Funny you should mention this whole thing about new, because that's exactly what it is. It's a new way of shooting. It's often new equipment and new ways to view that content. Right now, there's really no way to accurately view high dynamic range, which when you do view it on the...
Well, just like any new format, like 4K or high definition television, you got to buy a new TV monitor and have the right equipment in order to see it.
Right.
But HDR, all these studios have digital cameras now. They're not shooting, you know, some people still shoot on film. And film is compatible with HDR, right? You're capturing enough information that you can edit and display in HDR, correct?
Yes, if you go back and
read... Celluloid is great!
Yes, when you go back and remap, you'd have to go back and grab the negative and pull all that information
in. Well, if you shoot a new movie.
Right, correct.
Right, you can shoot on celluloid and then edit and present in HDR.
Correct.
What about all these high-definition cameras you got out there?
Yeah, you can't
Are they all useless?
Well, they're not all useless because certainly... Between software upgrades and minor alterations, you can actually shoot in HDR depending on
so
the camera.
So it's not that they're all trashed the way projectors are.
No, although I will say this. A lot of people are pointing out, a lot of the cameramen, that they're learning how to use a camera over the course of 18 months. And as soon as they're done, there's a better camera that does twice as much. So the camera refresh rates, which used to be 10 years...
And they're never learning artistically what they can do and getting comfortable and learning and dealing with it at an optimal professional level, because as soon as they master it, they got to move on to something new.
Right. And
it doesn't matter if it's different. And it doesn't matter if it's quote unquote better. They're not able to take full artistic advantage of what they have because they keep having to jump into something new.
And even if they do want to take full artistic advantage of it. Sometimes they can't because, like high dynamic range, HDR, they shoot it in HDR, but then they can't even view it on set or in the post house.
Well, but that'll change.
That will change, yes. Now, Now you asked, the comparison is 4K is more pixels. HDR is better pixels.
How can it be better?
Well, instead
Isn't
of
a pixel a generic, you
each
know.
Pixel captures more data. So instead of it only being 8 bits, it's 12 bits. or 10 bits. So it's
with the same number of pixels?
With the same number of pixels, yes. So each pixel has more data in it.
Okay, so why do people care? First of all, we know theater owners suddenly have a much bigger bottom line expense than they've had in years, and that may just force them again with keeping prices up higher and higher and wanting to try and soak you with premium pricing. Filmmakers, just shoot in celluloid, for God's sake. But what about consumers in the home?
Okay.
They're already, if you walk into a store, you're going to have like 3D compatible and probably a 4K monitor. It's going to say 4K on it. But when you bring it home, there's no 4K programming to watch. And do you even have the equipment that you can watch 4K even if the programming is available?
Well, that's a great question, because really what we should be talking about, Comcast has a 4K channel. Okay, so they can get 4K to you into, let's say, your set-top box.
Uh-huh.
But from your set-top box to your television, your brand new 4K television, if you're going down an HDMI, which is kind of a standard cable.
Which is what everybody has, basically.
Right. Or the new version of HDMI, HDMI 2.0 even. HDMI 2.0 is 4K compatible barely. Mm-hmm. However, DisplayPort is 18 gigabits per second.
So you're saying that the tools and the cables and the things hooking up the cable box or whatever it is to my TV, to me, I'm not getting 4K.
Correct. It's the problem is getting from the set-top box onto the television. The connections for current television sets aren't really fast enough. It's like trying to shove too much data down a straw. You just
let me put it this way. I'm a tech guy, sort of. You know what I mean? I love toys. I love new things. I was excited by the CD player. I was excited by the DVD. I appreciated Blu-ray and the fact that it was backward compatible. So that, hey, all right, you asked me to buy a Blu-ray player, but I can play all my DVDs on it. Okay, you've won me over. You're making it a value for me. I like my high definition television. That's amazing. Once I could afford it and it was at a certain price level, I stepped it up. But I'm not some sort of fanatic. You know what? If you're going to tell me, oh, you're going to get 4K, but already you can see that Netflix has a premium pricing charge that they want to do, and you want, if they think this is an excuse for me to buy a new TV, it's not. I'm only going to buy a TV when my old one wears out. And if they think it's an excuse to charge me more for my cable programming, it's not. I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to resist it. I honestly don't care. My picture looks great. You got something new and it's easy and everything will work fine with it. And I can see it's better. Lovely. You've kept me as a happy customer. But if you think that's an excuse, like the theater owners, to like charge me extra for a good screen and picture, like they do now with their premium pricing, with their faux IMAX, if you think your cable company is going to charge me more, oh, it's 4K programming, you're going to have to pay an extra $4 a month to get. No, I'm not doing it.
Well, and there were certain panel members on all these panels, and I'll place links in the show notes to all these stories that kind of go over these different. They were technical panels, but they were saying, look, do not get 4K Netflix. There's no point, because a couple reasons. One, coming into your house right now, most people only get 3 megabit per second. So that is the speed at which data can get to you. Well, you can't actually get 4K content
but
at that
rate. Even when it's available, even when it's technically possible, even when it's there, I'm not paying extra just for the delight of 4K.
Okay, no, right. I understand that. I'm trying to go over the reasons why, at least for now.
Yeah, but that's a technical thing. That's just it's not actually real 4K. Yeah, exactly. Like when you go to an IMAX theater, it's not really IMAX. It's just branded IMAX, and they're branding the 4K, but you're not actually getting the 4K image that you should, because all the equipment and the bit down rate, blah, 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 it's not in place. I understand that. It's a ripoff. I understand. But that's not saying 2 years down the road, when it's genuine 4K and everybody has the equipment and I can view it in 4K, don't think that's an excuse to charge me extra. Don't think I'm going to run out and buy a new TV, because people aren't going to do it.
Yeah, it's funny. Pete Putnam said, and he's kind of a consumer electronics guy, he said that television is not a very good business to be in right now, because, you know, the margins are so thin.
And everyone bought a big TV and they're happy.
Right. And he said the Chinese are the only ones making any money at it. And they'll do anything to make you get rid of your 2-year-old smart TV that you just bought, because they have to. And they've over-manufactured all of this what he called glass, which is LCD screens, and they did it in 4K. So it's not a matter of whether you have to pay more for the television. The 4K price will come down to a reasonable level for each set, but there won't be any 2K television sets. The reality is, for right now, even if you could get content, very little of it can make its way to your television set. In fact, I'll go one better. An Academy Award winner for Hugo, I think Ben Grossman is his name. He was talking about, he owns an effects firm, and he said that he's often asked to create 2K effects. So he does all the special effects, and rather than do it in 4K, which will cost a fortune because you have to do everything twice, or everything is, you know, twice as much data, the rendering time is 2.5 times greater. He says that producers come to him and say, look, just do the effects in 2K, not 4K. So finish the film in 2K, but don't tell anyone that you're doing that, because we're going to master it in 2K and tell everybody that it's 4K. Oh. So we're gonna advertise 4K, much like all the movie theaters do.
Nice.
But every single effects movie, Transformers, Oblivion, any effects movie, name the effects movie, and everything is shot in 4K or 6K. And by the time it gets done, the effects are all in 2K. So they can't even go back and say, well, we're going to upgrade it now and remaster. Well, you can't, because the effects are all 2K. So you're not going to get any more information out of it.
All right. So the takeaway, so the gist is,
even if you have 4K, you're still going to be getting 2K until they make 4K content in HDR.
Right. And people, theater owners have a big new expense. They're now under pressure to replace or upgrade their film projectors a lot more often than they were in the past. Consumers are not going to upgrade their TVs a lot more often than they have in the past. So, you know, these people are creating all these formats and all this stuff and all this premium deluxe stuff. Oh my God, it's so great. People aren't buying it. They didn't buy 3D in the home. They're not going to go crazy for this stuff. They're not going to spend tons of money and upgrade quicker than they normally would just to get it. So,
well, and to your point,
I think,
Michael,
it's a lot of tech chasing after money that isn't there.
And to your point, Michael, on these panels, a lot of people said, look, you're going to hear a lot about 4K. We're all hearing 4K, 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 because the marketing people at these consumer electronics manufacturers, they got a hold of 4K and they're trying to push something new down the pipe, and 4K is ready. But the reality is, we don't think, as people who look at this stuff and who can see the what's really differential, yeah, it's a little better 4K. Yeah, I guess.
It was the wrong road. They're much more excited by HDR.
Yes. They're saying, you know what? People aren't going to pay more for that. Now, HDR, when they see it, they might go, wow, that's great. Let me call my friends and have them come over and look at this. This is amazing. I'll pay more for that. Well, that they think maybe. But Dolby Atmos, the difference between 5.1 and Dolby Atmos, you know, maybe not.
I think basically when theater owners and studios should think, we want to keep people coming to the movies. We want to keep them in the habit of going to the movies. Anything we can do to increase the experience and make them happy customers is great. But using every new technological trick in order to say, hey, let's jack up the price, that's a mistake.
It has to be worth it.
No, nothing's worth increased prices. Not since color.
Oh my gosh. Well, that kind of wraps up the show for this week. I think we were able to explain the technology of it all during Inside Baseball, don't you?
After an hour of what do you call it? Not detox, but an hour of...
acronyms?
An hour of acronyms, that's for sure. Where you debrief. Yeah, we debrief for an hour just to try and get to that muddled explanation. So hopefully it was a little clear.
Yes. And what Michael means is, before we started recording, we actually talked for an hour about all of this.
Well, about that one thing in particular, because I didn't understand any of it.
Yes. But if you didn't understand some of what we were talking about, please do feel free to write us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, which is now, by the way, Stitcher was purchased by Deezer. Although we're still there, Stitcher's still there. So please do subscribe to us in one of those podcast aggregators, rate, review the show in any one of them. It really does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to contact us, all those ways to subscribe to us. You can even find ways to follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our username. Or you can like us on Facebook, where we can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, that information is at showbizsandbox.com. That is our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a revolving website, and this week it is what, Michael?
Why not shootin' celluloid.com.
Or, you know, you could also find Michael at filmisnotdead.com or
that's right.
Or some of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry can be found on The Huffington Post or at michaelgiltz.com. You can also try bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
And by the way, if you're fans of MGMT, I should have mentioned they're playing in Europe, Central and South America. They're in Brazil on November 1st, Lima, Peru, November 4th, Santiago, Chile, November 6th, Rio de Janeiro back in Brazil on November 8th, and Buenos Aires in Argentina on November 9th. So my God, if you're down south, go check them out.